The only play was to catch an Uber to the airport and jump on a flight home. He'd fulfilled his end of the bargain both to Ding and Peter. Sometimes discretion really was the better part of valor. Except that when Jack looked at the object perched on the table next to his passport, he no longer saw a cheap plastic toy. He saw a curly-haired boy with tears streaming down his face, trying to pry his penny free from the schoolyard bully's dirty fist. Sometimes a good man has to be willing to pay a price for doing what's right. Jack smiled as he threw a handful of shekels onto the table before grabbing both the passport and the action figure. The next direct flight to the States didn't leave for another 4 hours, plenty of time to run an errand on his way to the airport. And if the detour meant pissing off Tal and her partner, that was too damned bad. Worst case scenario, Jack would get a second chance to talk to a beautiful woman. What could go wrong with that? Chapter 6 Altanf Outpost, Syria.
Say that one more time.
Kerry gave a long sigh, looking from the man asking the question to his commander, seated directly behind and to the left of the questioner. Kerry raised his eyebrows, giving Captain Alex Brown his best, "Do I really have to deal with this shit look?" As team leaders went, Captain Brown was pretty switched on. Unlike some of the officers Kerry had served with, Alex saw his role as an A-team leader as the pinnacle of his career, rather than just a stepping stone to bigger and better things. In a break with tradition, Alex had been an Apache helicopter pilot prior to attending the grueling selection process required of all those who had aspirations of someday wearing the Army's coveted green beret. This unorthodox career path opened Alex up to untold amounts of ribbing from his contemporaries, but also a degree of begrudging respect from his men. After all, as anyone who'd served in the infantry for longer than a day could attest, aviators had things pretty damned cushy, all things considered. Someone who traded the hot meals, 8 hours of crew rest, and not insubstantial flight pay that accompanied the Army's silver aviator wings for a 100-pound rucksack and endless nights sleeping in the mud was not on a mission to make general officer. No, men like Alex Brown were exactly the type of leaders Kerry had hoped to find when he'd joined the ranks of the Green Berets. This was why, when Captain Brown met Kerry's look of exasperation with an understanding nod but a gesture with his hand to continue, Kerry exhaled his breath in a noisy rush and began his story again, for the third time. "Like I said before," Kerry said, keeping his tone civil while making no attempt to hide his grimace of frustration. "Sergeant Mustafa and I saw General Ahmadi enter the compound at 1300 local time. When we broke station 3 hours ago, he was still inside."
"And you're sure it was him?" the CIA case officer said.
Kerry stared at the man standing in front of him before answering. In the way of soldiers everywhere, he compared the man to his own commanding officer and found the intelligence operative wanting. While Alex looked like the special operations officer he was, the agency man had a spare build, which he compensated for with his oversized, condescending attitude. The intelligence officer's narrow features seemed to be set in a perpetual sneer, and his diction was distinctly professorial, as if he were teaching a graduate-level course in international relations rather than tracking down his nation's enemies. Everything from the man's stance to his manner of asking questions was patronizing. Simply put, Kerry didn't like him, and he figured the feeling was probably mutual.
"What's your name again?" Kerry said, no longer attempting a civil tone.
"Bill. Bill Jones."
"Of course it is," Kerry said.
"I guess all the John Does were taken. Here's the thing, Bill. I'm a special operations-trained sniper. Most people think that means I'm a good shot, and that's true.
but it's also a bit like saying that a NASCAR driver is really good at parallel parking. Shooting is part of my job, but not the main part. A sniper's primary function is observation, seeing and remembering things. Things that may not seem to be important at the time, but could be critical when a pair of MH-60s loaded with assaulters is 30 seconds out from a target. I'm not trying to be a jackass, Bill, but if I tell you that General Farhad Ahmadi walked through the compound gates, he fucking did. Got it? Kerry felt the flush that came when he was truly angry building at the base of his neck at about the same time Jad, who was seated next to him, kicked him in the shin. Okay, so maybe that last sentence was a bit too much, but damned if this CIA or OGA or whatever the hell secret squirrel acronym they were now using wasn't getting under his skin. In Kerry's experience, CIA case officers came in two variants, field spooks and desk drivers. If this debriefing session was any indication, the man currently known as Bill Jones definitely fell into the latter category.
I think what Sergeant Marks is trying to say is that he and Sergeant Mustafa both had ample time to observe the target and independently confirmed his identity. Is that about right, boys?
The interruption came from Captain Brown, who was doing exactly what good officers were supposed to do, stepping into the breach on behalf of his men. The former aviator's stock took another jump in Kerry's eyes. Turning back to the agency operative, Kerry opened his mouth to follow his commander's salvo, but Jad beat him to the punch.
Exactly right, sir, Jad said, folding his arms across his massive chest. And our satellite link and recording equipment both ticking a shit right exactly when Ahmadi's convoy arrived only adds credence.
What do you mean? Bill said, his pinched features narrowing.
I see it like this, Jad said, his surfer's drawl somehow at odds with the seriousness of the situation. You agency boys have been using drones of one kind or another to remotely smoke targets of opportunity with absolute impunity for the last two decades. We both know the dumb jihadis died a long time ago. The ones that are left are smart, and I think they may have figured out how to rebalance what has been up until now a pretty lopsided battlefield. I recalibrated both our radio and the digital recorder as soon as we returned to base. They're both fine. But both pieces of equipment failed at the exact moment a high-value target rolled into our sightline. It doesn't take a genius to guess why.
Enlighten me, Bill said.
You sent us in instead of using an agency drone for a reason, Jad said. I'm assuming that reason has something to do with the drone's performance. Either the video stream crapped out as the bird arrived on station over the compound, or the drone lost its satellite navigational fix and had to return to base. How am I doing so far?
Bill didn't say anything. He didn't have to. His expression spoke volumes.
Now, Chad said, taking the case officer's silence as affirmation. I'm shit for flying drones, but I do know a thing or two about the RF spectrum. I think someone has developed the ability to burn out the military frequency bands using a high-energy pulse rather than persistent jamming. Otherwise, we would have picked up the interference on our own SIGINT devices. That would account for our loss of comms, and if the jammer was putting out enough juice, it could scramble our video equipment as well. The video recorders we use are top of the line, which means they're commercial off the shelf. They perform a hell of a lot better than the shit the government buys, but because they weren't built with this mission in mind, their circuitry isn't hardened to mil standards. The amount of juice the bad guys must be throwing into the atmosphere in that micropulse could easily bleed from the sat radio into the attached peripherals.
So the general's vehicle is equipped with some kind of customized jammer, Kerry said.
In addition to being hands down the best spotter he'd ever worked with, Jad was also a gifted echo.
Unfortunately,
When he talked radios, Jad sometimes forgot that not everyone had the equivalent of a degree in RF engineering from MIT.
"Isn't that what I just said?" Jad said, a look of genuine confusion on his face.
"Focus, gents," Alex said. "Jad, do you mean that our local David Koresh has access to this pulse jammer too?"
"Not necessarily," Jad said, smiling as the conversation came back to one of his two favorite topics.
"Just stating the facts, sir. I leave the wild-ass guesses to people like Bill." This time it was Kerry who kicked his teammate in the shin, though his heart really wasn't in it. Despite his impressive size and formidable appearance, Jad was as easygoing as they came. If the agency pencil pusher had managed to piss off the nicest man in all of 5th Special Forces Group, there really was no hope for him. Even so, Kerry was a master sergeant. He'd already been boarded for sergeant major twice without success. In its bureaucratic way, the Army had let him know that he had climbed as high on the career ladder as he was liable to go. That knowledge came with both pluses and minuses. On the minus side, he wouldn't be bringing home an E-9's retirement pay when he finally decided to stop kicking in doors in favor of heading back to the family maple syrup business in New Hampshire. On the plus side, his days of worrying about a politically incorrect attitude affecting his chances of promotion were a thing of the past. Not so with his spotter. Jad was still a sergeant first class, or E-7 in military parlance. He needed to be promoted once more before retiring, and bullshit spats with government partners had a way of making it into a soldier's promotion files. Kerry opened his mouth, preparing to take the heat off his spotter with another smart-ass comment, but again his team leader rode to the rescue. "Mr. Jones," Alex said, interposing himself between his men and the agency officer. "Is there anything else? If not, let's wrap this up. My guys have had a long day and will undoubtedly have another long one tomorrow." Damn, but Captain Brown was on it. As much as Kerry hated to admit it, the young officer's directness was refreshing. Perhaps Special Operations should be recruiting more Apache aviators to fill their ranks. Bill looked from Alex to the two knuckle-draggers and seemed to remember where he was for the first time. Because of the sensitivity and urgency surrounding their report, Bill had come over to the 5th Group compound rather than making the snipers troop across the road to the CIA's collection of buildings. As such, this debriefing was taking place in the team room, one of the more sacrosanct spaces in an ODA's environment. This is where team members serviced and stored their gear, conducted pre-mission briefings and post-operations debriefings, and generally gathered to shoot the shit and keep one another company. In other words, the ramshackle collection of battered tables, broken chairs, and chain-linking closed gear lockers, and the pictures of former team members killed in action hanging over the obligatory miniature bar in the room's back corner, were hallowed ground. An outsider did not come into the Holy of Holies and question the integrity or professional competence of team members. Not without consequences, anyway. Bill cleared his throat before speaking. This time his words came without condescension dripping from each syllable. Not an apology, exactly, but maybe a start. "My assets reporting is at odds with what your men saw," Bill said. It didn't pass unnoticed to Kerry that the agency man had said "saw" without a couple of adjacent words that might have substantially watered down the verb. Again, not an apology per se, but things did seem to be moving in the right direction.
"Interesting," Alex said. "What did your asset report?"
Now it was the agency man who sighed before replying.
"He said that the visitor was one of the local Syrian militia leaders coming to pay his respects. Because of the influence the cult's leader exerts on the local community, quite a few of the tribal chieftains have been trying to make inroads with him."
"How reliable is your asset?" Alex said.
Bill shot the former aviator a distasteful look before replying. The new spirit of détente notwithstanding, Alex had just done the equivalent of challenging the case officer to a dick-measuring contest. A spy's worth was directly tied to the accuracy and value of the reporting he or she obtained from their assets. An asset who reported false information was of zero value, a sentiment that applied doubly to their handler, who hadn't been able to determine the veracity of the so-called intelligence before passing it on. And that was only the tip of the iceberg. An asset discovered to be lying had a cascading effect in that every bit of reporting the man or woman had ever provided now had to be called into question and either independently verified or, as was more often the case, discarded. This was not how junior CIA case officers successfully advanced through the ranks to the rarefied air of Langley's seventh floor. Bill's defeated expression seemed to indicate that there was quite a bit of previous reporting on the line. "His other reporting has been validated to an extent," Bill said, clearly hedging. "But this discrepancy isn't one we can ignore. Setting that aside, if Ahmadi did stop by, it wasn't for a social visit. We need to know what he's doing there and why. We need eyes inside that compound." "Maybe we can kill two birds with one stone," Chad said. Carrie looked at his spotter, trying to understand what the man was suggesting. Then he knew. "No fucking way," Carrie said, shaking his head. "Not going to happen." "Come on, boss," Chad said. "You said it yourself. Maybe my cousins know a thing or two." "I also said you should make Jocelyn an honest woman, but you don't listen for shit about that. Why start now?" "Hey, guys," Alex said, "what if for a minute we pretended like I was your team leader? What gives?" "My spotter was out in the sun too long today, sir," Carrie said. "He must have suffered heat stroke because the words coming out of his big mouth make zero sense." "Please excuse my friend, sir," Chad said, talking over Carrie. "He sometimes forgets he's my team sergeant and not my mother. I happen to be a native Arabic speaker who spent my first 12 years in the local neighborhood. Bill here wants to know whether or not his asset is legit, and we all want to know why the Quds Force commander has suddenly taken an interest in an apocalyptic cult. I'm simply suggesting that I put my good looks and linguistic badassery to use by taking a look around inside." "I like it," Bill said. "Absolutely fucking not," Carrie countered. "Again," Alex said, holding up his hand. "I think I read somewhere that I'm actually in charge. Bill, Bob, John, or whatever the fuck your name is, Jad is my responsibility, mine. I don't put the lives of my men in jeopardy on a whim. Don't get me wrong, we do some pretty hinky shit around here. There's a reason why we're called Special Forces, but we don't do half-assed. Not now, not ever. So if you want to use one of mine on an operation, I'm all ears. But the op gets planned and controlled from here. Otherwise, we are done talking. Capiche?" Bill grimaced like he'd bitten into a rotten peach, but he nodded all the same. "And you," Alex said, turning to Carrie, "enough with the Mother Goose shit. Give me just a little bit of credit. If we do this, it will be done right. And before you ask yes, you will be the one providing overwatch for Jad. Tracking?" Carrie paused for a moment and then slowly nodded. "Yes, sir. I get it." "Good," Alex said, turning back to Bill. "Now, assuming Sergeant Mustafa was cleared to participate in this operation, how would it go down?" "According to my asset," Bill said, "the VIP will be back tomorrow. It would be great if Sergeant Mustafa could tell us why." Which was exactly what Carrie was afraid he would say. Sometimes, he absolutely hated being right. Chapter 7.
Tel Aviv, Israel. The man known as Jonathan Mills kept a warm smile plastered on his friendly face as his stomach churned. This was the moment of truth, the instant in time in which all the work from the previous 6 months either bore fruit or exploded in his face. In the lexicon of businessmen everywhere, this was the close, the final interaction determining whether the person he'd been working agreed to the terms of the deal or not. If Jonathan was a corporate salesman, this would be where he met or missed his yearly quota. But he was not a businessman. He was a spy. In his line of work, a missed pitch didn't equate to an anemic bonus or a poor performance review. It meant death. The potential asset's death for sure, and potentially Jonathan's as well, depending on how badly he'd misjudged the situation. While the profession of espionage has always been a bit more rough and tumble than selling stocks, in the more civilized rules that guided the interactions of the world's superpowers, an unsuccessful pitch rarely resulted in anyone's death. But the country Jonathan was operating against had never been known for its genteel civility, especially with regard to adversarial intelligence services. "I'm very grateful for your help," Jonathan said, smiling so broadly his teeth hurt. "It's people like you and I who were able to help our countries move past the petty squabbles of today in favor of the lasting relationships of tomorrow. We are patriots." Except that the bespectacled, middle-aged man sitting across the table from Jonathan was not anyone's idea of a patriot. He was a mid-level manager with three unremarkable children and a plain-looking wife. If that had been all, the man's tragic but all too common existence would have probably never come to Jonathan's attention. But that wasn't all. Not by a long shot. In addition to his pedantic family life and dead-end career, the dark-haired man had another aspect to his existence, one that Jonathan had found infinitely more interesting. The ordinary-looking man had rather extraordinary taste in women. Specifically, younger women with a yearning for the finer things in life. The kind of things a manager who'd been passed over for a lucrative promotion in his booming technology startup in favor of a wunderkind half his age could not afford. At least not without a little help. Like all good case officers, Jonathan understood that the bespectacled man's motivation went beyond just providing his newest arm candy with an IWC Portofino watch. He was angry. Pissed off might be a better description. At almost 50 years old, Jonathan's quarry had finally come to the realization that all men eventually reach. His professional life had peaked and was now on the decline. It wasn't just that the plush assignments were no longer offered to him. No, the latest promotion he'd pursued had gone to a man-child barely out of university, the kind of spoiled creature who expected a six-figure salary just for showing up to work each day and then bitterly complained when he didn't get one. Except this time, the spoiled creature had scored big, leaving the bespectacled man to digitally shout the situation's injustice to his social media followers. If he'd had any. And while this phenomenon was not uncommon in Tel Aviv, also known as the Silicon Valley of the Middle East, it still didn't rise to the level of Jonathan's attention. After all, in a city in which new startup dreams were conceived each and every day, it was inevitable that a few ended in nightmares. Even over-leveraged and angry, there was nothing particularly interesting about Jonathan's mild-mannered companion. Not without his second job, anyway. The bespectacled man's additional job was just that, a distraction that took him away from his hot startup one day a week. But what a distraction it was. Like many in Israel's professional workforce, the man was an IDF reservist, A citizen soldier, as it were. Except that this man did not report to an army base and draw a Tavor rifle while pretending to be a warrior. No, his reserve duty was much more interesting. The bespectacled man, Yossi Cohen, took a sip of coffee as his pale eyes studied his tablemate. Jonathan knew what the other man saw, the epitome of a serious, yet harmless, American. Jonathan had blue eyes, a shock of blonde hair that he wore long, spilling over his forehead in curly waves, and chubby cheeks that framed an ever-present smile. Though he was in his late 30s, Jonathan projected an earnestness more in line with the naivete often ascribed to youth. Or Americans? Jonathan knew that it was this naivete, this childish innocence, that put Yossi at ease, allowing him to believe that he, not Jonathan, was the one who was dictating the terms of their relationship. And this was completely fine with the man known as Jonathan, who was not in the least bit naive. Not that Yossi needed to know this troublesome detail. "Tell me again what you will do with the information," Yossi said. His expression was deadpan, completely devoid of emotion. They might as well have been discussing the beautiful Israeli weather, to judge from the bored look on his face. Except the long, elegant fingers of his right hand were in constant motion, first spinning his coffee cup on its saucer, then tapping out a quiet staccato on the table's edge. The fingers said there was more at stake here than just idle gossip. "Sure," Jonathan said with another radiant smile. "Our two countries are at an impasse because of politics. You and I are going to shortcut the bureaucratic bullshit. You give me the software hooks, and I'll network your system into our current architecture. Then I'll set up an off-the-books demonstration for my friend at the PEO weapons office. He's promised me that if he can verify the system's capabilities, he'll push the necessary customs paperwork through. In a month, 2 months, tops, the U.S. Army will finish the procurement they started. We'll sell more systems, Israel will have an overseas customer, and American service members will have the protection they need. Everyone wins." Yossi stared back without speaking, as if he were weighing Jonathan's words, as if he wasn't already doing the conversion from dollars to shekels in his head, as if he hadn't already visited a designer boutique on Rothschild Boulevard last night to shop for his blonde girlfriend with the big tits who lived in Florentine. Not to be confused with the brunette with the shapely ass who preferred the Neve Tzedek section of Tel Aviv. For a man with as many women as Yossi, it wouldn't do to confuse one mistress's taste for another's. That kind of thing could land a man in trouble. "I'm not entirely comfortable with this," Yossi said. "But I also am not the sort to let bureaucracy stand in the way of keeping our American allies safe." "A man after my own heart," Jonathan said, "and believe me, the last thing I want to do is make you uneasy. So, how about this? Why don't we make our arrangement official? I'll hire you as a consultant. My company already has a technology assistance agreement in place with the Mafat. We can add you to the paperwork tonight. Of course, we'd need to pay you a reasonable salary just to keep this all on the up and up. How about $10,000 a week? You've been helping me for the last couple months, so let's do a lump sum of $100,000 to get caught up. Will that work?" For once, there was a crack in the man with the face of stone. $100,000 was double what they'd flirted with in the dance of betrayal up until now. But the man known as Jonathan was supposedly an American businessman, and Americans were nothing if not generous. "Yes," Yossi said, gulping to hide his surprise. "I would feel much better if this was documented.
Of course, Jonathan said, waving away Yossi's concerns. I'll send an email back to the office as soon as I get to the airport and have my assistant send over one of our boilerplate agreements to get things kicked off. That said, I don't want to wait on paperwork. Why don't we get the payment out of the way now? And the contract can catch up later this afternoon. What account would you like the money wired into?
Yossi rattled off a string of numbers and Jonathan dutifully entered them into his phone. A moment later, Jonathan hit the send button and Yossi's phone chimed in return.
Well, I guess that's that, Jonathan said. So how about those hooks?
Without so much as a twitch, Yossi reached into his pocket, removed a thumb drive, and slid it across the table.
Excellent, Jonathan said, collecting the memory stick. Thank you again for your help. You have my gratitude, as well as that of the American people. You've just made both our nations safer.
In truth, Yossi had done nothing of the sort. But that didn't bother Jonathan in the least. Mainly because the man known as Jonathan was not a businessman. And he certainly wasn't American.
Chapter 8. The man formerly known as Jonathan Mills edged into the shadows offered by the narrow alleyway, making his way deeper into the predominantly Arab village of Ojami, located in the southern portion of Tel Aviv. Men who looked like Jonathan weren't typically seen among the brown faces who inhabited the multitude of dwellings, stacked on top of one another in haphazard fashion like the perennial Leaning Tower of Pisa. Then again, few men were like Jonathan. For starters, the man formerly known as Jonathan Mills wasn't American, or Canadian, or even European for that matter. At least not in any sense of the word that mattered. Though he spoke English with a Midwestern accent, Jonathan had never set foot on American soil. He did have his mother's looks and language, but beneath the curly blonde hair and fair skin, he was his father's child through and through. And his father hated Americans with a passion unmatched by any other country, save one. Israel. So it was with no small amount of satisfaction that Jonathan selected a door at the end of the alley, gave two quick knocks followed by two longer raps, and then stole inside. The pair of men waiting in the dimly lit room beyond held pistols. Both were pointed at Jonathan. He understood. Jonathan had been mistaken for someone else his entire life. On the first day of school, he'd realized that he looked completely different from his classmates. In the days that followed, he'd been subject to taunts and torments from the other children. But this had also been part of his father's plan. A career employee of the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and Security, or MOIS, Jonathan's father had seen in his progeny a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Now, almost 30 years later, that opportunity was on the cusp of being realized. But only if the two imbeciles with guns didn't shoot him first. "Assalamu alaikum, brothers," Jonathan said, his hands raised chest level, palms facing the gunman. "I believe you have something for me." "Who are you?" the nearest man said, his eyes squinting in the darkness. The man's face was pinched and drawn, bringing to mind a rat. Jonathan instinctively didn't like him. He looked like he should be nosing around on the floor for a scrap of cheese, and his finger foolishly rested on the pistol's trigger. Jonathan decided then and there that regardless of what happened in the next several seconds, the man's time on Earth was rapidly drawing to a close. "I was told to knock four times on the front door before entering," Jonathan said, keeping his smile in place. "I hope there weren't too many other men given the same instructions." Though Jonathan's Arabic was flawless, Ratface scrunched up his nose as if he didn't understand.
which might just be true, Hamas foot soldiers weren't known for their intelligence.
"You look American," Ratface said, edging a step closer.
"That's the point, you idiot," Jonathan said, allowing his smile to fray.
"What did you call me?" Ratface said, now standing close enough to punctuate each word by jabbing the pistol's barrel into Jonathan's chest. The metal stabbing into his breastbone was hardly a charming feeling. Jonathan endured the unpleasantness exactly twice. On the third time, Jonathan slapped his hands together, sandwiching the pistol's muzzle between them, while jerking up and to the left. Ratface's wrist snapped, and the pistol discharged. Though Ratface's companion didn't know it, Jonathan had actually done the man a favor. Since Jonathan was right-handed, he typically performed this particular disarming technique to his dominant side, which meant the new bullet hole in the plaster wall would have resided in the man's head instead. But Jonathan was not a barbarian. Besides, as much as he detested hired help, he needed at least one of these goons for what came next. Ratface, on the other hand, was completely expendable. Between the muzzle blast from the unexpected pistol discharge and the equally unexpected lightning bolt of pain from his snapped wrist, Ratface was looking a bit dazed and confused. He'd reacted to the pop of his radius snapping like a turkey's wishbone by cradling the wounded wrist against his chest with his good hand, leaving his lower body unprotected. Jonathan capitalized on this oversight by punting Ratface squarely between his spindly legs. The would-be tough guy reacted predictably, crumpling into the fetal position. From there, it was a simple matter for Jonathan to step forward, place the pistol against the groaning man's head, and pull the trigger. Or at least that's what he'd intended to do. But just as his finger began to take the slack from the trigger, a voice interrupted him. "Wait!"
Those screamed. The exclamation was more plea than command. And this saved Ratface's life. If the wait had been an order, Jonathan would have squeezed the trigger in the smooth, even motion for which he'd been trained, and then probably done the same to Ratface's compatriot, help be damned. But something about the other man's plaintive tone gave Jonathan pause. Jonathan lived by wits, and right now, his intuition told him to delay the fool's execution. At least for the moment, anyway.
"Why?" Jonathan said. His pistol was still squarely affixed to Ratface's head, and his index finger still held tension right at the trigger's breaking point. Less than a millimeter of additional pressure, and Ratface's brains would be decorating the floor.
"Because he's my brother," the second man said. "The man who briefed us didn't say you'd look like an American. My brother was just being cautious. Don't kill him, please." Jonathan weighed the man's words, testing their veracity, while pressing the pistol harder into Ratface's forehead, dimpling the skin. The brother's explanation was plausible. Probably true, even. Jonathan's appearance was his greatest asset, allowing him to move unmolested through target countries in a manner in which his father's people never could. These Arabs were low-level operatives. Operational security certainly dictated that they know as little about Jonathan as possible, including his appearance. As Jonathan knew from personal experience, the Israeli intelligence apparatus was a fearsome adversary. Even so, Jonathan's instinct said that Ratface was a liability, and in Jonathan's line of work, liabilities were handled in just one way. "Please," the second man said again, as if hearing Jonathan's thoughts. Shifting his attention from Ratface, Jonathan looked at the brother. Slim, perhaps 5 years younger than his sibling, with dark hair and an honest face. His hands were lifted above his head, his pistol angled up and away from Jonathan. Unlike Ratface, there was no cruelty in his expression. This was the thinker, the intellectual,
who had probably bailed his older, headstrong brother out of too many problems to count, an older brother he was risking his life to save. Jonathan would have given much to have had such a brother. With a sigh, Jonathan lowered his pistol and took a step away from a still kneeling rat face. "Get me the device," Jonathan said. "Now." The younger brother bobbed his head and practically ran for the back room. A moment later, he reappeared holding an innocuous-looking box. Reaching into his pocket, Jonathan took out the thumb drive Yossi had given him and tossed it to the brother. "Put that in the slot," Jonathan said, "and push the button." The young man did as instructed. For a moment, nothing happened. Then a single LED on the side of the box glowed green. A second later, the acrid smell of an electrical short filled the apartment as a thin column of gray smoke drifted up from the device.
I'm sorry,
the brother said, holding the still smoldering box up as if it were a burnt offering.
I did what you said.
And because of that, your brother lives, Jonathan said, backing slowly from the apartment, his pistol swinging from one man to the other. For now. But if you want him to stay that way, you need to do one more thing.
What?
Forget you ever saw me. And with that, Jonathan slipped from the apartment as silently as the wisps of smoke escaped from the box. Chapter 9. The man who'd called himself Jonathan was not a Jonathan at all. His name was Darian Moradi, and while his accent and features came from his mother, Persian blood coursed through his veins. At this moment, this ancient blood was warning him that he needed to get a grip on his emotions before he made a mistake that was less survivable than the two Palestinian morons he'd left in the apartment. Even at its most tame, the game of espionage was not hospitable to second chances. And nothing about an Iranian intelligence officer operating in Israel was tame. Slipping into the alleyway in front of the apartment, Darian realized that he still had the Arab's pistol stuffed into his waistband. Swallowing a curse, he stared at the garbage littering both sides of the moldy cinder block walls, looking for a way to remedy his oversight. Though it was surrounded on all sides by enemies, Israel had a positively Byzantine approach to personal weapons. The general populace was not permitted to own one, period. Anyone found carrying an unauthorized weapon would be a prime target for a Shin Bet interrogation cell, regardless of how wide his smile. Darian needed to ditch the pistol. Fast. Striding across the fetid water puddling in the street, Darian made for a promising pile of garbage. As per the less-than-pleasant smells emanating from the stacks of plastic bags, this particular heap hadn't been disturbed for quite some time. Perfect. After a final check to ensure he was alone, Darian removed the pistol from his pants, ejected the magazine, and racked the slide, catching the shiny bullet as it tumbled through the air. Though children probably frequented the alley, he hadn't rendered the weapons safe because of humanitarian concerns. They might share a common enemy in Israel, but Arabs and Persians were hardly friends. In fact, Darian had a feeling that, were it not for the Jews, Hezbollah and Hamas would be at each other's throats. Now, Darian had a much more practical reason for ensuring the weapon wasn't accidentally discharged. Gunshot wounds drew police, and the last thing Darian wanted was one of the many pairs of unseen eyes peeking through the curtained windows overlooking the alley to report a blonde-haired, blue-eyed American to the Israel police. This was why he'd spared Ratface's life back in the apartment, instead of putting the creature out of his misery as he'd so clearly deserved. At least, that's what Darian told himself. Sticking the bullet into his pocket, he poked through the trash heap until he found an unclosed bag. He then disassembled the pistol, wiped it clean, and shoved the components into the mass of squishy, half-decomposed rubbish. Once the gun's pieces were completely hidden from view, Darian sanitized the remaining round and dropped it into the bag. Then he dusted off his hands, trying not to think about what he'd been rummaging through. Breathing with his mouth, he tied the ends of the bag together and started toward the pool of light shining from the mouth of the alley. Now that he'd put the encounter in the apartment behind him, it was time to get his head back in the game. By now, the data on the thumb drive had been decrypted and was in his countrymen's hands. Phase two of his operation was about to begin, and Darian had somewhere to be. Fortunately, what came next should be a walk in the park compared to the last several hours. For the first time since setting foot on Israeli soil, Darian finally felt like he could breathe. Until an Israeli police car pulled past the alley. Chapter 10. Unlike police the world over, law enforcement officers in Israel do not turn on their lights just when they anticipate pulling someone over. Instead, cruisers constantly have their light bar activated as they go about their business. Darian's handlers had warned him about this unique cultural phenomenon before he'd infiltrated the Zionist state, so at first he wasn't overly alarmed when red and blue strobing lights cast writhing shadows across the alley. At first. But worry reasserted itself when the police sedan stopped at the mouth of the alleyway, reversed direction, and then headed straight for Darian. Darian hated the Jews with the best of his countrymen, but that didn't mean he couldn't admire their culture. Right now, a particularly apt Yiddish proverb sprang to mind. Men plan, and God laughs. Though if there were any laughing from Darian, it would be the sort that precedes hysteria. First, he'd had to deal with the Arab brothers who between them had the equivalent of half a brain. Now he had the great fortune to make the acquaintance of the Israel police. Wonderful. The car eased to a stop about 2 meters away as the driver flicked on the headlights, spotlighting Darian against the dank concrete. Suppressing a sigh, Darian smiled his best clueless American grin and gave a little wave. He could have tried to run, but there was no point. The alley was probably a dead end, and no one outruns radio waves. His best defense was to play to the Israelis' assumptions. He was an American tourist who'd lost his way. He was delighted to see the police. At least that's how Darian hoped the encounter would go. The police cruiser's doors swung open, and two patrol officers exited, a man and a woman. The woman was about 5'2" and slightly built. The man was bigger, but still no match for Darian's American-sized frame. Though he'd never met his mother's family, Darian would someday like to, if for nothing more than to thank them for their genes. The great Satan they might be, but when it came to going toe-to-toe with Israelis, American size and strength was greatly appreciated. Howdy, Darian said as the two officers approached. Sure glad to see you. He was smiling so wide his lips hurt, but as it had many times before, the ruse seemed to work. Israelis were a suspicious people by nature, and the ones who staffed the law enforcement and intelligence communities doubly so, and with good reason. Still, it was hard to see an American tourist as dangerous in this context. Much like a puppy who's found its way into a neighbor's home, the best thing to do is gently put the well-meaning animal back outside while making a few chastening noises. Why waste your time disciplining the dog when it didn't have the capacity to understand what it had done wrong in the first place? Are you lost? The man said. His English, while good, was accented, and Darian felt an immediate sense of relief. Israel enjoyed one of the greatest propaganda programs ever conceived under the guise of something known as Taglit Birthright Israel, or the Birthright Trip, as it was more commonly called. Originally founded in December of 1999, the program financed trips to Israel for Jewish American teenagers, paid for by wealthy Jewish businessmen and other donors. The program's benefits were twofold. First, most anyone who participated left Israel with an overwhelming positive impression of the Jewish homeland. Second, a good number of Americans decided to return to Israel after graduating from high school to join the IDF and earn their Israeli citizenship. Running into one of these Americans who had made Aliyah was Darian's biggest fear. For non-Americans, he could play the American stereotype to a T. But if he encountered someone born and raised in the United States, Darian knew his legend had limitations. Fortunately, the Israeli's thick accent reassured Darian that he had nothing to worry about. Until the woman began to speak.
"You're American," she said. "Me too. Where you from?"
And that was the million-dollar question. Even people who'd never traveled to America could usually name three states, New York, California, and Texas. To the uninitiated, everyone from New York was sophisticated and probably a snob, while Californians were laid back and smooth. Texans, on the other hand, were unfailingly polite patriots and generally harmless. Accordingly, Darian had cultivated a Texas persona. "Texas," Darian said. "Fort Worth."
"No kidding," the woman said. "I'm from Arlington. Where'd you go to high school?"
Darian had never set foot in America, much less Fort Worth, Texas. Even so, he was an excellent case officer, and excellent case officers always backstopped their stories.
"James Martin," Darian said. "Graduated 15 years ago. You?"
"Arlington High," the woman answered, taking a step closer.
"I graduated about the same time. I think our football teams played each other at state that year. Remember?"
"Sorry," Darian said. "Believe it or not, I'm not much of a football fan. I know that's sacrilegious, but there it is." The woman smiled. But Darian was not assuaged. As they'd been talking, her male partner had taken up a position off Darian's right shoulder while the woman remained at a 45-degree angle to his left. In short, the two of them formed the base of a triangle with Darian at its point. This setup was advantageous to the two police officers for a number of reasons, the least of which being that their vantage points now offered them intersecting fields of fire.
"What are you doing in this alley?" the woman said.
She was small in stature, had a slim build, and was quite pretty. But she was also a Jew, which meant her nimble mind was already working on ways to catch Darian in a lie. Time to go on the offensive.
"Got turned around somehow," Darian said. "Is the park back that way?"
He gestured over the male officer's shoulder, and the man instinctively looked where Darian was pointing. Which was a mistake. A mistake the policeman realized he was making as he turned his head. To his credit, his sixth sense seemed to tell him something was amiss while his head was still in motion. Unfortunately for him, by then Darian's elbow had already connected with his temple. While Darian was not an expert on Texas high schools, his MOIS cadre had ensured that he was adept at a much more useful discipline. Unarmed combat. Darian snapped his hip into the strike, picturing his elbow entering the man's skull and exiting through his mouth in a spray of blood and gore. And while he hadn't put enough force behind the blow to accomplish that, the strike was more than adequate enough to bounce the policeman's brain around his cranium. As the policeman crumpled, Darian caught his falling body and stepped behind him, using the concussed cop's unresponsive form to shield himself from his partner. While the Jewess drew her firearm and racked the slide to chamber around with admirable speed, she hesitated when confronted with her partner's limp form. Contrary to the movies, shooting in a hostage scenario was a daunting task. One misplaced motion and the 9mm round intended for Darian would wind up in her partner instead. But Darian was under no such constraint. Stripping the policeman's pistol from his holster one-handed, Darian racked the slide on the officer's web belt and fired a single round. At this distance, he really couldn't miss. The slug took the former American squarely in the chest. She collapsed. Releasing his hold on her partner, Darian allowed the man to slump forward, putting a single round in the back of his head as he fell. The pistol's report was deafening in the alley's narrow confines. But that couldn't be helped. In any case, Darian had one more loose end to tie off. Edging around the bloody mess that had been until moments before a breathing human being, Darian towered over the female officer. As he'd suspected, she'd been wearing a vest, and it appeared to have done its job. While she was gasping for breath, in considerable pain, she was still alive, which was unfortunate. "Please," the woman said, holding her hand out, palm up. "I..." Darian fired the gun twice, and the encounter was over. Darian might someday second-guess his decision to spare the Palestinian brothers, but he did know one thing for sure. The world was a better place with two less Jews inhabiting it. Taking out his cell, Darian dialed the brothers. He hoped the smarter of the two would answer. The phone rang once, twice, three times. On the fourth, someone picked up. "Yes?" "There's a mess outside," Darian said as he strode into the shadows. "Clean it up." Darian ended the call without waiting for a reply, but he felt confident the men would heed his instructions. They knew what he was capable of, and the two murdered Israeli police officers would only reinforce their thinking. After all, cleaning up dead bodies was preferable to becoming one.
Chapter 11.
"Hey, good looking. What you got cooking?"
Jack smiled in spite of himself. This was partially because, while he considered his life a bit more interesting than the average American's, he'd never heard Johnny Cash sung with a Hebrew accent. But that only accounted for part of his smile. The majority of it had something to do with the ray of sunshine with twin dimples smiling at him from the driver's seat of a Toyota Corolla. "Use that line often," Jack said, crossing from the street corner on which he'd been standing.
"First time," Tal said with another grin. "It would be wasted on an Israeli boy. I had to wait for the right American to come along."
Jack leaned against the doorframe. He could smell an intoxicating blend of coconut and vanilla. He wasn't sure if the scent was body lotion, shampoo, or something else. He didn't care. All he knew was that the inside of the car smelled like heaven.
"Are you getting in, or do I need to find another American?" Tal said.
"Getting in," Jack said. "Definitely getting in." Tal replied with another dazzling smile. Jack pondered the very real possibility that he was losing his mind, but found himself scrambling toward the passenger door anyway. A throaty growl snapped him out of his revelry as Tal redlined the engine just as he was rounding the hood. Jack jumped, and he could hear a peal of feminine laughter over the engine noise. Definitely losing his mind. Upon deciding that he was going to try to find the woman and Tommy before leaving Israel, Jack had bitten the bullet and called Tal. After all, he was probably already under both passive and active Shin Bet surveillance. Israel was surrounded by Islamic militants willing to trade their own lives for Jewish corpses. by this metric, Israel's domestic intelligence service was constantly on war footing. As such, Jack had no illusions about his ability to elude the organization's watchful stare. Instead, he decided to subscribe to the maxim, if you can't beat him, might as well join him. Besides, finding the two Americans would be much easier with the Shin Bet's considerable resources. And then there was the other reason. Intelligence operative or not, Tal was a pleasant diversion from what until now had been a fairly disastrous trip. That said, only a fool let a pretty smile distract him from what was undoubtedly a capable intelligence officer. Unfortunately, as the KGB's infamous success with honey traps had proven, the world was full of fools, and most of them possessed both X and Y chromosomes. "Ooh, this one's my favorite," Tal said, cranking up the radio's volume as Jack belted himself into the passenger seat. A familiar haunting baritone filled the car, waxing poetically about a ring of fire. "You really like Johnny Cash," Jack said. "Love him," Tal said, sliding the car into drive and accelerating into traffic with the casual lack of self-preservation common to all Israeli motorists. "But I only bring out this playlist for special occasions. I'm more of a red dirt country fan. Are you from Texas?" "Baltimore," Jack said with a smile. "Sorry." Tal said, shaking her head in mock disappointment. "My first American, and he's not even a cowboy. Such a shame." "Does that mean dinner's off?" Jack said. Tal turned from the maze of vehicles to give him an appraising glance, and Jack felt his pulse quicken. This was partially because a car slid in front of them with a complete disregard of traffic norms more akin to a Daytona racetrack than a busy city thoroughfare, but only partially. The real reason he was having trouble forming coherent thoughts had more to do with the intensity of the brown eyes evaluating him, like he was a slab of meat. He should have felt offended. He didn't. "No," Tal said, shifting her attention back to the road just in time to switch lanes to a chorus of several pissed-off horns. "I think you'll do." "What made you call? I didn't expect to hear from you so soon." Implied but left unsaid by the Shin Bet officer was that Jack would have called her eventually. She was probably right. "Here's the deal," Jack said, digging Captain America from his pocket. "I need to find the woman from the market." "Why?" Tal said, threading her way through the stop-and-go traffic like she had feet instead of inches to spare between her car and her fellow commuters. "Her son dropped this," Jack said, setting Captain America on the dashboard. "He'll want it back." Tal glanced at the action figure before giving Jack another look, this one also appraising, but for perhaps a different reason. "I thought you didn't know her," Tal said. "I don't. But her son reminded me of a childhood friend. I think the action figure is important to her son. Important in a way that a replacement toy won't be. I'd like to return it, but I don't know where they're staying or the mother's name. But I do know someone in the Shin Bet." "Are you sure you're not a cowboy, Jack Ryan?" Tal said. "The older I get, the less sure I am about anything. But I'm about as city as they come." "I guess you're right," Tal said with a mock sigh. "A cowboy would have made a pass at me by now." "Don't take this the wrong way," Jack said with a laugh. "But what would you know about cowboys?" "Much," Tal said, brown eyes warming to the topic. "My father taught at an American university in Montana while I was a child. He fell in love with country music and cowboy movies. It's how I learned English." "Who's your favorite cowboy?" Jack said. "Real cowboy? Probably George Strait." "Movie cowboy?
That's easy. John Wayne.
A man's got to do what a man's got to do.
Tal pitched her voice low as she spoke, doing a fair mimic of the Duke's distinctive drawl, and Jack found himself laughing again.
That's pretty good, Jack said. Are all Shin Bet officers this talented?
Jack Ryan?
I am unlike anyone you will ever meet, Tal said, suddenly serious. Is return